This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Trello help power global collaboration for all teams so they can accomplish everything that's impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. Atlassian.com. Atlassian. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more.
There's no better feeling than a personal win, and the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Shouldn't you be at work?
It's a lovely chip! Oh, it's a brilliant goal from Lord Pohino!
Still, it's not away. Southgate's shot. Milosevic scores.
DPR could do with a bit of magic from him. Maybe this is it. It is! Andy Sinton from nothing.
Brian Roy has headed Forest into the lead.
Whelan. Oh, what a goal from Noel Whelan.
No power on it whatsoever, but Taibbi has made a horrendous error.
Now, you know him better than anybody, probably. Do you back him to score quickly, yes or no?
Yes.
Oh, and it hasn't.
No.
Hello and welcome to Quickly, Kevin. Will he score? I'm Chris Gold. Joining me, Josh Widdicombe.
Hello.
And a man with the best barnet this side of Attilio Lombardo. It's Michael Marder.
Hello.
How are you both?
Yeah, good. I don't know why I felt the need to go after the hair.
No, I think that... It
just breaks it out. Attilio Lombardo hasn't come up much.
He hasn't, actually. He was quite a comedy figure in the 90s, even though... Did he, like, play for Italy? He was certainly good, wasn't he?
Definitely too good for Crystal Palace.
But the thing... That's talking of too good for Crystal Palace, we've got Richard Shaw on today. Yeah, he was a bit of a comedy figure because he had... because obviously, like, there was other bald players, but he'd not shaved it off, had he? So he'd got the side bits.
What's known in the industry as a Willy Thorn.
He'd got a Willy Thorn, yeah, exactly. I don't
gone
think
full
he'd
thorn.
Know that.
I think I'd have that if I let it grow back now.
Would you be tempted?
Well, no, because I think you have to be beyond a certain age to pull that look off. Like, Patrick Stewart can pull it off.
Yeah.
I think at 40... You look absolutely insane.
Michael, if you could have the hair of one 90s footballer, who would you choose?
Oh, how long have I got it for?
And Chris, would you comment if Michael turned up with Carlos Valderrama's hair and was just deadly serious? I don't know whether I'd say anything. Like, you know how you don't say something if there's... Like, Tom Crane of this parish, if someone's wearing an awful item of clothing, and you'd be aware of this if he ever does this to you, if someone walks in there wearing a terrible piece of clothing, his knee-jerk reaction is to compliment that piece of clothing.
My wife does this. Like, if she wears something I regard as a bit outlandish, she'll always come back and go, plenty of people complimented it. And I think, maybe they just didn't know what to say. It's really, like, it's garish. You have to comment on it and you can't go, what is that? You go, oh, that's interesting, nice.
Is there an argument that a good piece of clothing is like a referee in that it's best when you don't notice it?
You don't notice it, yeah.
Now that you've said that, every time for the last 3 years I've met Tom Crane, he's complimented something I was wearing. This is like when my mum told me Santa Claus didn't exist.
This is the end of The Usual Suspects.
Fuck, I thought he was such a nice guy.
And you were such a fashionable guy. I thought that string vest was a good look, but Crane commented on it. Right, shall we get into some correspondence?
I'm Jim Rosenthal, and this is the Electronic Postbag.
You've got mail.
This is from Dan Thompson from Stourbridge. Hello all. Just listened to today's John Hare episode, and I'm responding to Josh's request for obscure ways in which football club owners of the 90s made their money. Step forward, Mr. James Jim Driscoll. Jim was my local club, Stourbridge FC's chairman in the early to mid-90s, having made his money as the writer and creator of the early morning cartoon, The Shoe People.
Oh, wow. Do you remember the theme tune to the Shoe People?
Yeah, I love that.
Shoe People.
Oh, yeah.
It's really
so. I was trying to think about this. It was kind of like each shoe had a different personality based on what kind of shoe it was. Obviously, it was a different time. I think there was like a rough round the edges shoe that was a tramp, wasn't there? You can't say yes. That word, but I think he was called Trampy. So I think one of the shoes was called, but it was a different time. And then there was maybe a ballet shoe.
Yeah.
Was there a red stiletto or was that a bit racy?
I just remember the opening titles. I don't really remember any storylines. The opening titles were like a conveyor belt and all the shoes were just kind of dancing down until they ended up in a big bin or something.
No, that's Raggy Dolls.
That's Raggy Dolls.
That's Raggy Dolls.
They're all combined in my mind. I can't untangle
the owner of Raggy Dolls. The guy who invented Raggy Dolls, I'm Staley Brusselter. I fucked that up. The guy that owned, the guy that wrote Raggy Dolls. Oh, fuck it. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. You get the joke. Leave it in as is. If people can't join the dots on that.
The intention was there.
Because there was that kind of thing in the 90s where I realised the Shoe People's different. But where like big famous people were like considered that they might become... Like I remember rumours that Oasis were going to buy Man City.
Yeah.
And was there rumours that Robbie Williams was going to buy Port Vale?
Yeah, that rings a bell.
But do you think like these people's wealth is just simply nowhere near enough now, is it?
I think I can confidently say Robbie Williams could have afforded to buy Port Vale.
Do you think though?
Yes. I mean, how much would that cost?
No, but then the overall cost of it. Suddenly you're hemorrhaging £3 million a year or whatever.
Well, it depends on if Port Vale are going to go out. If Port Vale are going to go out and buy Alan Shearer, they might be in trouble.
Yeah.
I suspect. Yeah.
Like now, do you think there's a celebrity? Do you think J.K. Rowling could, like, buy Hearts?
I thought you were going to say J.K. from Jamiroquai.
Do you think J.K. from Jamiroquai could buy Port Vale? I don't know. I mean, how much money do you get from the Shoe People? It can't be loads, can it?
I've just looked into that while you guys were talking because I was like...
I thought you'd gone quiet.
Yeah, how much money is there in the Shoe People? So this is incredible. This is from the Wikipedia page, right? It was broadcast in 52 countries around the world. It was the first series from the West to be shown in a former Soviet Union.
There's always money in that, isn't there?
Huge money.
It became so popular, they sold 25 million books.
Wow. That's mad.
Pound a book?
That is insane.
That was a big thing in the 90s. Like things, English things that you don't really consider being actually huge in these kind of like former Soviet blocs. Remember Norman Wisdom?
Yeah, Norman Wisdom was huge in the former Soviet blocs.
England played Albania in Albania, and at halftime, Norman Wisdom came out, and the crowd went unglued over the sight of Norman Wisdom.
It is weird, isn't it? Obviously, Mr. Bean is the classic
one. Mr. Bean, I was about to say that. Yeah, Mr. Bean.
That's so the Shoe People is it was a. I hadn't thought about it since I was a child, but now, obviously, if anyone else has got football clubs owned by unlikely people, then you know how to get in touch. Now, I think we need to draw a line under this name game. Shall we try and find the winner?
Okay, let's declare it.
So the numbers of the name game have got out of control. Okay, so shall we start with this from James Smith? This is a no-quibble run of 27 footballers. That's his words. Michael, Charlie Adam, Adam Thomas. By the way, can I just draw attention to the guy who sent one that said that it started Neville, Phil Neville. And then he sent a follow-up email saying, ignore that last email. Okay. He'd got a zero. He'd scored a zero. Charlie Adam. Adam Thomas. Thomas Robert. Robert Elliot. Elliot Lee. Lee Todd. Todd Jordan. Jordan Graham. Graham Anthony. He used to play for Argyle. Anthony Paul. Paul Bernard. Bernard Joseph. Joseph Christopher, Christopher Stern, Stern John, an absolute classic move I've seen played many times. Do you all want to sing along with the next one? John Collins. Collins John. John Terry. Terry Connor. Connor Ronan. Ronan Curtis. Curtis Nicholas. Nicholas Pepe. Pepe Juan. Juan Martin. Martin Taylor. Taylor Richards. And that's it.
How many is that?
27.
27? It's a masterpiece. I
mean, it's impressive in its length, but I'm going to go back and echo my previous sentiments.
No flair.
No flair. It's boring. Sorry, I know a lot of work probably went into that with cross-referencing and God knows what, but it's just not enjoyable.
Well, this person's got a risky 36.
Can I just say,
and that's what I want to hear.
I really enjoyed Michael just then saying, it's impressive in its length.
Tom Halliday. Ian St. John. John Collins. Collins John. Jonathan David. David Edgar. Edgar Davids. David James. James Matthews. Matthew Ryan. Ryan Bertrand, Bertrand Robert, which in brackets is Laurent Robert's less successful younger brother.
Now we're talking.
I presume he's also a footballer. Robert Graham, Graham Alexander, Alexander Glenn, in brackets early 1900s, Glenn Murray, Murray Davidson, David Lucas, Luca Tony. Are you allowing Lucas into Luca?
Yes, yeah, I'd rather they took a few risks. Okay, and it
Tony Adams, Adam Phillips, Philip Max, Max Arons, Aaron Pierre, Pierre Laurent, Laurent Robert.
Just Laurent.
Lovely, lovely little shortcut there. Yeah.
Robert Lee, Lee Martin, Martin Allen, Alan Lee, Alan apparently played for Napoli, Lee Matthews, Matthew Matt Elliott, Elliot Lee, Lee Dixon, Dixon at 2-0, and you can't go on from there.
That's Michael.
I'd like to say that's the winner.
Yes. What do they win?
We'll send them some 90s goodies.
Okay. Can we have the Richard Keys sting?
It was just banter. It was just banter. 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 It was just banter. 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 It's just a little bit of fun.
This is from Ross Matthews.
My favourite sting of all time, that, by the way, but please go.
Yeah. Hi, Japs. Absolutely love the show. It just gets better and better, and the episodes make lockdown bearable. Some best bits from Richard Keys' blog can be found below. March the 16th. Postponing the season was a no-brainer. How that fool Boris Johnson couldn't see that, I have no idea. Perhaps soccer isn't on his radar. Just rugger. And sending children to school to play it during a pandemic. God help us. Do you know what, though? I think I agree with Richard Keys. January the 21st. If I could get all my predictions right, you wouldn't be reading this now. I'd have done the lottery when I lived in the UK and fucked off a long time ago. Predicting is a dangerous business. I've been haunted by mine that Everton might finish above Liverpool two or three seasons back. Liverpool fans have never let me forget it. Why they don't seem to remember, though, is that I predicted the title win for them last season and went again this time around. Well done, me.
To say well done, me, without a hint of irony. What a man.
I don't know whether it's because you narrate both of them, but that felt like it was the new Steve Barnes novel when you were reading that.
He is similar to Steve Barnes, isn't he? In that there's this kind of old school self-righteousness about him.
Yeah.
Do you, of all the people we've celebrated, who do you find the most fascinating out of Richard Keys or Yuri Geller or Steve Barnes?
In a sort of fantasy dinner party scenario, I think I'd want Yuri Geller there.
Yeah, because he'd do tricks.
Yeah.
They're not tricks, he's actually a wizard. That's his whole shtick. I'd want to spend time with Richard Keys. I feel there's so much that is unknown. I think he's such a deep, complex character. You could spend years with him and not really know him. I'd want to begin that process.
Do you think that's what Andy Gray's doing? He just can't quite get to the bottom. He can't solve Richard Keys.
The enigma wrapped in a riddle that is Richard
Keys. Did we ever have, talking of our other cult heroes, can we just do one more? Because this will blow your mind. We've got this from a couple of people, but Dylan Todd is the one I'll read out. Thank you for everyone who wrote this in. Hi, chaps. Just been listening to another podcast where ex-Sunderland and Leeds player Michael Bridges was being interviewed and the subject of David Batty came up. According to Michael Bridges, on an away trip, all the players were asking each other what they would love to do if they got the chance. Apparently, David Batty's ultimate fantasy was to walk in on someone breaking into his house, catch the burglar and lock him in the garage and torture him for a month.
What? That's outrageous. Also completely believable.
Yeah, isn't that Just also, thank you for everyone who said there was a sighting of David Batty applauding in Clap for Carers montage as well. So thank you for that as well. He has shown his head with respect this time. Left his house wide open as also for a burglar to get in the back.
Can we talk about something that hasn't really come up on here before, which is that Duncan Ferguson beat two burglars, like it was burgled on two separate occasions and beat the burglars within an inch of their life both times. Do you remember
that? No, I vaguely remember.
Yeah. Huge story in the 90s. I think that story made so many headlines because you think of all the footballers' houses to burgle, Duncan Ferguson, and for him to be in and incur his full wrath. Because I think like the wrath of Ferguson on a football pitch is he's probably operating at 60% there. But like, if you're burgling his house, Ferguson on a 100 is terrifying.
Do you think if you're burgling Duncan Ferguson, do you think you're just burgling a random large house in, say, Southport or wherever he lives?
Well, do you think the burglars kind of broke in not knowing whose house it was? And then there's that sit. They're there with their flashlights. They look around. They're grabbing all the kind of silver-plated dishes and the jewellery. And then one of them flashes.
Sorry, the silver-plated dishes.
What do I mean? You know, like, well, I don't think Duncan Ferguson would have those. But quite ornate, maybe expensive gun, antique guns on the wall.
Yeah.
And then the flashlight cast upon a framed picture of the Ferguson family. And just the single tear rolling down the burglar's face. I like to imagine that's as they turn to their right and see Ferguson on the stairs in his pyjamas.
Oh, my word. I don't think there's a scarier footballer than Duncan Ferguson.
Is it worth asking that anyone who has an idea of a footballer's house from the 90s that you would like to burgle and least like to burgle?
Yes, it is worth asking.
I imagine that. Alan Wright will be up there because he's most likely going to be in his bath. But if you've got any ideas, allow it quickly, Kevin.
Steal his gold-plated bath.
Get in touch with the show. Email hello@quicklykevin.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter @quicklykevin. And sign up to the mailing list @quicklykevin.com.
So our guest this week offers a textured story of a 90s footballer. 207 league appearances for Crystal Palace. He spent a spell with Hull and is most known, probably fans of this podcast, for his spell at Coventry in the mid-90s. This is the story of that night when Eric Cantona got sent off, but a whole lot more. This is Richard Shaw. Our guest today is a defender who made 587 career appearances, becoming a legend for both Crystal Palace and the team we are always accused of ignoring, Coventry City. Here to right that wrong, it is the man Eric Cantona kicked first. Welcome to Quickly Kevin, Richard Shaw.
Thank you, guys. Thank you for reminding me as well. While we're reenacting it, yeah.
Good. We will come to Cantona.
Absolutely.
And Coventry.
And Coventry. We will come to Coventry,
They're doing very well now.
They are doing very well now, but we ignore that, obviously. We don't like to look post-1999.
Just to clarify, has anyone ever asked you about that Eric Cantona?
I'd say January 25th every single year since 1995. My phone goes and I'm asked to say something on the lines of Eric. But I guess it was just a unique incident as well, because I don't think it's ever been seen.
Not
before.
Since or since? Before, really. No. Did you realise in that night, did you think, this is going to be a big deal?
Well, I was actually sitting on the floor from being kicked and being a victim, so I would say, rather than the accuser. but it was a strange situation. And then I just heard the crowd, there was a raucous in the crowd, and I saw, I think if you look at the footage, Chris Armstrong sprinting towards the incident. I don't quite know what Chris was going to do, I have to say. But he was sprinting towards the incident. And then the next thing you know, the first I saw of it was afterwards on, you know, on TV. I'd never seen it live. But it was just... Yeah. I mean, I do look back. I can see why people make a big thing of it, because it's the first time. I think since then, I think Jamie Carragher threw a coin at someone in Arsenal, Highbury, once.
Yeah.
But I don't think anyone's quite... gone to the length of Eric.
Well, there's plenty of rumours that you're actually responsible for it. We'll get into those.
But let's start when you started out as a player. We're always interested with professional footballers. How much better were you than everyone at school?
I was, actually, Josh, yeah. And you don't even understand it sometimes, because I think at school football, and I do believe this now, there's not enough of it, not enough kids playing, say, street football, where you sit in South America where they get the ball and beat 15 players and score a goal.
Yeah.
In them days, you don't see them so much now, but back in the day, it was like that. And I believe it or not, I mean, my goal scoring record was absolutely rubbish.
Four.
Right. That is, I think three of them I was in midfield at Palace, so and one of them was goal of the season at Coventry, so that is my claim to fame. But as a youngster growing up, I scored loads of. You play for your school, your district side, your county side. And back in the day, you could go schoolboy training to every single club, whereas now you have to sign on for an academy.
Yeah.
And I was literally one night at Southampton, one night at Chelsea, not the Chelsea that there are now, by the way.
Yeah.
One night at Wimbledon, the old Wimbledon, one night at Palace. So you could have a little flavour, but you was playing literally every single day and every single night.
Yeah.
And it was fantastic.
And were you, what position were you in those days?
I was midfield player, and then I wasn't too bad. And then I don't know why... I think maybe you start, I don't know, you always ease your way back. You have a centre forward or midfield player. But I actually like defending. I know it sounds bizarre, but I always had a good sense of reading the game. And I actually quite, I was one of them ones who didn't need to score a goal. I took great delight in winning the game or keeping a clean sheet or being a destroyer.
Which is lucky, really.
It goes to game
it's
ratio.
Very lucky because my goal scoring record wouldn't have got me one contract. I have to say.
What games did you play as a kid? Like, was it like three and in, headers and volleys?
It was that, Chris. It was World Cup. Yeah. I'm in World Cup. I'm playing at Kingfield Primary School, World Cup. And if you score, you go through.
Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah, and the last one now. Yeah, the last one scored out.
So if I was on a lazy day and thinking about maths homework or something, I thought, well, I'll get within the group where I know I can be the last two and I could still score and win, just save me energy or something on life.
Really? Wow. You would that is reading the game well.
Yeah, it's reading the game well. So I think back then I sort of knew where I was. But yeah, I mean, you were just playing on the street. You'd take some paint and put goals on brick walls and play. Wow. Just constantly play football. And there's not enough... Nowadays, I see people, you can't do that, you can't play, you're overloading this. No, kids have to play. That's the only way they learn.
Yeah.
That's the only way they learn.
Did you think this could be it, a career for me?
No. Do you know what, John? I left school and my first thought was going to work in a bank, believe it or not. Yeah. When I left school, I was going to go to sixth form college and then Crystal Palace offered me an apprenticeship, as did Wimbledon. And that was the first time it sort of hit me. I thought, well, okay.
It's a job.
You know, this is going to be my job, yeah. So I chose Palace only because I think with the youth team, we had a guy called Alan Smith there who since went on to manage reserves and manage. And I still call him dad to this very day, despite him absolutely hammering me at times and this and that. I still refer to him as my father because I grew up not having a father and he was a real big help. And so the coaches at the academy level were so good and so welcoming. It was the only club for me that I was going to sign for.
And on that day to day of that, like you, there's all the cleaning the boots and like, brilliant. Was it proper? Did you
it
love that?
It was brilliant. Do you know what? And look, the game's moved on.
Yeah.
I understand that. I do. I'm not one of these people at Gale Gym. I'm not because, and good luck to the guys today. And I do love watching football. I love football. I'm not saying I like it all the time. But I do love it. But it just gave you discipline. You know, this is your job. Do it to the best of your ability that you possibly can. I'll say it to anybody now. Whatever job you do in life, do it to the best of your ability. Have pride in what you do. And we had a guy called Maurice Druitt. I remember his name. And he would literally, before the end of the day, if your jobs weren't done, he'd literally go through skirting boards, be like, oh, no, dust, everyone back in, right?
Oh, no.
And he'd,
the
find, he'd find dust in areas where you know no one's even going to matter. And so we literally leave there, the training ground, at 5, and I had to get 3 trains home. So I'd literally be back. And then I was up early doing a cleaning job because we never had no money. So I literally woke up at 3:30 every single morning, and I worked from 4 till 6 as a cleaner before my job at...
Wow. And then so you're going to Palace and presumably you're cleaning up there.
Cleaning up there as well. I was a top cleaner. I was very good at it. And I was earning more money as a cleaner than what I was at Crystal Palace. And I was working from 4 till 6. And then literally from 6, I literally get a train up, 3 or 4 trains up to Mitcham where we trained and start work. And because I wasn't such a bad player, I was a decent player as in my youth team. I play in the reserves as well. So if the reserves were away at, say, Tottenham, I'll get back at 1 o'clock in the morning. No car, bunking trains, walking through the park, 3-hour walk home. I literally get in at 1 and literally I'd have 2.5 hours sleep.
Wow.
And straight into a cleaning job. Done it for 2 years.
Man.
And for me, it sort of made me the person
Yeah.
I like honesty. I like loyalty. I like people say it as it is.
You like cleaning?
I like cleaning. I'm very like cleaning, yeah.
But I guess that's why they do that. Those drill instructors do that in the army, is to get you kind of regimented and to get you, make you work to a schedule. And I guess that's the benefit of doing that back in your day.
Oh, every manager I worked under throughout my career, if someone was really strict with me and had a discipline, like Gordon Strachan, for instance, Steve Cropper had it his own way, I sort of gravitated to that because I just thought, I like that. It's given me structure. It's given me a purpose in what I'm trying to do. And I actually really enjoyed that side of it.
Was there anyone else in the youth team at that point that kind of made it out to the level you did?
I was with John Slarko.
Oh, yeah?
I was with John Slarko. John was a terrific player. And if he hadn't had the injury that he had, I think he played against Leeds. I think it was a collision with Mel Sterling. I think that night, if I believe right, Liverpool were going to make a bid, and Bari in Italy.
Really?
And that night he got injured. Unfortunately.
Oh, wow.
I mean, John was a wonderful, wonderful
player. So quick,
great. And he was a real, shall we say, cheeky chappy where, you know, he had a lot to say for himself.
Yeah.
John, a lot to say. I mean, I remember Ian Evans walking down the corridor at Mitcham, which wasn't the most salubrious of training grounds. He was the assistant manager. I remember John Solarco commenting quite funnily on his new haircut.
And
on the assistant manager. And the assistant manager continued to turn around, grab John by his big afro and put his head down the toilet, I think, like the toilet, someone along the line. Can you imagine that now?
Well, you were recently a coach at Crystal Palace. Like, have you ever run your finger along a skirting board and said to the lads, come on, what's this?
Do you know what I have to say? Because of my background, because of my past, I always make sure the 23s clean the tables. And whenever they eat, I mean, you can ask, I know the 23s, I mean, if you ever get Aaron Bissaka on it, for instance, because Aaron was one I used to make, wait, clean it up, because he'd have dinner and there'd be rice all around his plate. And I used to go throw him a cloth, and I was just to make sure, guys, had the respect, because the chefs there, they're not here to wait on you. You know, make sure you take your plate back, everything like that, and you clean the table. And do you know what? They really got into a great habit. So they used to go around, clean the tables when they finished, and it was all done. And they've got a lot of respect for that.
Yeah.
So, and I think that was from my background. I hope the lads take it on.
Yeah.
I hope they do.
Yeah, yeah.
At Crystal Palace at that time, there was quite a big character in charge of the whole thing, Ron Notes.
Mm.
Did you have many dealings with Ron?
Not so much, because I was a young player. The only dealings I had with Ron, I think, was when I wanted a new contract. I think I was given about £5 a week raise and told.
Did you have to deal with it with him?
No, I used to go and see Steve.
Yeah.
Steve Coppell, and it was, I think, my first contract. I think was about £90 a week or something like that. And I worked out I was worse off than being an apprentice because you start paying tax. And I remember going to see Steve. Steve was a very methodical fellow, great manager. And you say, basically, what are you doing in here? And I said, Gaffer, look, I'm going to be worse off. And he said, what are you looking for? I went, I'm looking for that, that, and that. And he took one look at it, just went, scrubbed it, and goes, you're getting that, that, and that. Don't like it. Basically, go and find somewhere else.
Yeah.
And I stayed, obviously, for quite a few years. But contract-wise, I just deal with Steve. But Ron was a big flamboyant character, obviously, back in the day. I mean, I broke into the team sort of 89, sort of 90... You know, and went through. But that time, I think we came third in the Premier League.
Well, you're in the senior squad in 89 when they get promoted.
In and out.
In and out.
I was in and out.
You weren't in the playoff games, were you?
No.
Did you go to the... I did. They lost 3-1 at Blackburn.
That's right.
It was two legs in the olden days.
That's right, yeah.
So then back at Selhurst Park, Palace win 3-0.
That's been 3-0.
That must have been...
The crowd was... I mean, look at footage now, I think the crowd was literally about 10 minutes to go, standing on the touchlines. You know, I think we scored the last one, and it was just. I remember saying in the stand about that. I think we got promoted. It was just fantastic achievement with the players we had and what Steve Coppell had done. How we'd united, you know, from players that had been in non-league like Ian Wright and Andy Gray and Tony Finnegan, to the more established ones like Jim Cannon, obviously, and Dave Madden from Arsenal and Southampton. Steve was just a wonderful manager who'd put these characters all together, and it really worked.
What was Ian Wright like?
He was brilliant. I remember his first session. I think I was an apprentice and we were sitting there watching a practice game and he was literally running rings around Jim Cannon and Mickey Droy, who were the two established centre-halves. Basically, they were just trying to kick him, but they just couldn't catch him. He'd come from non-league. And I think initially, I think Steve gave him a three-month deal and I think he'd been different clubs, but just... just his acceleration, his pace, his love for the game. And you see it now when he's in commentary. He loves.
Was he exactly like he is now?
Exactly like.
What about the personality? Was he mouthy as well?
Oh, he had a lot to say. Oh my God, he had a lot to say. But in a nice way, you know. If he would, he would certainly let you know after games if you hadn't provided the right service for him or anything like that. But what a wonderful, wonderful character. I mean, if you set a goal up for him, he would come in Monday, like myself and John, because we're the two youngest ones. And inevitably, it was John who used to cross the ball for... If John had crossed the ball for Ian, and Ian had scored, Ian would come in Monday with one of his old cast-off shirts, like a Versace or something like that. But back in the day, it was like... dead. And then we'd go out on Saturday, and John would have this shirt on. He'd be walking around Croydon thinking, yeah, this is us. Yeah, this is us. In cast-off, Ian White's cast-off.
You know when you say, like, he'd have a go? Do players have big arguments in the dressing rooms after?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, they don't do it so much now, obviously, because it's obviously a different generation. It's a different world now. We all know you can't say too much now because people take things so much personal now. But back then, basically, like, whether it's right or wrong, you'd have an argument, but no one would hold a grudge. You'd do it because between 3 and 4 to 5, you wanted to win that game.
Yeah.
So anything went. Anything went half time, 3 to 4 to 5, the service not right. If you're not marking someone, if you're at fault, I mean, the rows I used to have with Chris Coleman and Paul Williams, and we're still, all three of us are best mates, you know, not doing your job properly, and you just get on with it. But they don't, it's not so much done now because
it is.
Are
you walking into the dressing room thinking, oh God, I'm at fault here, Chris Coleman's going to absolutely destroy?
I mean, we played one game, poor old John, go back to John again. We lost 3-2 at home, not been to Watford, I can't remember who it was, and John has scored 2 goals. So you kind of think, well, you're exempt from this, by the way. You've actually done all right today. We're coming in, Chris Coleman took his boots off and just threw them at him. Just said, like, you're a disgrace today, you know, blah, blah. And I'm sort of sitting there thinking, but he's scored 2 goals. And we've let in 3. So it must be me and you, surely.
Do you think that was a bit of deflection?
I think it was a massive deflection, yeah. He's walking off the pitch, he's like, oh, he's going to get it today, he's going to get it. I think, yeah, but we've conceded 3 goals. I think they've got to look at ourselves.
So you come up in 89, and then, like, the next few years are amazing for Palace, starting with that FA Cup run in 1990. We were interested because, is it right, was it, you played Cambridge in the quarters.
Yeah.
So you came up against John Beck's team, and John Beck's a bit
kind
of a legend.
Obsessed with John Beck.
Because of all these tactics he used to deploy, like rumours of putting too much sugar in the tea and the making the dressing room freezing. Did you experience that as an away team?
I do remember at Cambridge the throw-ins and the how long the grass was.
Was it really long?
Am I like, thinking
yeah,
it?
That's right,
it was
right.
Really long.
Saw, yeah, yeah.
And it was like, there'd be like towels by the side for long throw-ins and things like that. And do you know what? I never have an issue with that because there's so many ways to play a game of football.
Yeah.
I mean, people used to hammer the crazy game for winning the FA Cup. It's not purist. But what's right and wrong?
Yeah.
What suited Wimbledon? What suited Cambridge? And I've got... If they're the players you have and that's the way you play, good luck to you. You've got to try and find a way around it. But we did, I think that year, the cup run really sort of, we didn't play anyone of sort of note, shall we say, until Liverpool in the semi. Yeah. I mean, to draw Cambridge in the quarters was obviously a good draw for us. a very good draw. And I think we'd had Portsmouth and Rochdale in round 3 and 4. I can't remember we had 5. I can't remember we had. But we had a really good draw all the way to semi-final. Before you know it, bang, when the semi-final was like Liverpool, went, how did this happen? How have we got through to this?
And then you're playing Liverpool, but earlier in the season, and you were on the bench for this.
Yes, I was.
Liverpool beat you 9-0 at Anfield.
Yeah.
So, let's go through that night.
Wow, how long have you got, John? I mean, it's probably one of the best... look, just to sit and watch it live...
Yeah,
that side, and you talk about Liverpool and how well they're doing now, but it's almost like people forget pre-92 for the Premier League. Liverpool were one of the best teams in the world.
Yeah.
Not just Europe, in the world. You know, the European Cups they won, the team they had. I mean, they demolished Forest 5-0, I think, the following year. Nottingham Forest were a fantastic side. Yeah. But that 9-0 game, if you'd woke up next day and you'd gone Liverpool 21, Crystal Palace 0, you'd probably been about right. It was just...
9-0 was it was kind.
It was incredible. It was.
And were you
incredible.
Sat there going, I mean, are you going, can you appreciate that? Or you?
No, you can. And do you know what? The thing is, I think...
What's the atmosphere on the bench?
Well, I was warming up. We got to 2 and 3 and I was warming up. And as a young lad, you're thinking, you look at man, it's Anfield. I mean, there's the cop. I mean, like I said, I'm a big fan of football in the 70s and 80s, and you think from Shankly to Paisley, I think I want to get on here.
Yeah.
And I started warming up in front of Steve. I was sprinting. I was thinking, I was trying to catch the eye 2 or 3 nil down.
Yeah.
It got to 4 and 5. I just sat down. I just like hid in a corner. I was never going to get on. And we actually missed a penalty. I remember we missed a penalty. And Jeff Thomas missed it.
Would have got you back in the game.
It was, I think at the time it was 8-0. And I think Gary O'Reilly must have sprinted about 30, 40 yards just to console Josh, to tap him on his bum and kick your head up, son. It's 8-0. And one of the funniest things I remember, actually, is the game was going on, and Ronnie Whelan, who was a magnificent player, he actually turned around. I think the score was probably about 7 or 8. He actually turned around to Jeff Thomas and went, "Do you lot train with a ball?" It's just one of the funniest lines. You know, you only get the change of afterwards, and back then they had communal baths.
Yeah.
And you just sort of sitting there and think, you don't know what to say, really. I mean,
are you getting in the bath even though you haven't played?
Yeah. Absolutely. We're all in it together, aren't we?
And what's people, people shell shocked?
They were just shell shocked. Yeah, absolutely shell shocked. You know, it was because actually, in my opinion, that should never happen. If a team playing the same league should not be beaten.
I know
they've done it. I'm a Man United done it to. Leicester have done it recently to Southampton. But the only thing I would say, I remember watching Liverpool play that day, and although you shouldn't get beaten 9-0, I know, but it was just a wonderful, wonderful performance. They were an unbelievable team.
Did anyone say that in the dressing room? Was anyone like, bloody hell, they're good, aren't they?
Yeah, I think Brighty did, actually. Probably in a bath going, not bad, they might.
what did your manager do? Like, you can't be angry, like, kicking boots.
No.
I'm sure it's just...
Steve was a really, really good manager. You know, whenever Steve spoke, it always had a meaning to it. He was really good with us. Didn't rant and rave. He wasn't one of them guys. He spoke with a lot of common sense. I just don't think he said anything. I think we just left it for a couple of days. I mean, obviously, you wake up next morning, there's no phones. You just go and buy a paper, didn't you? Back of the paper, nice. So you're always reminded of it. And I think we had Southampton away on a Saturday. And I think it was all quite nervous. I think the players were nervous. Obviously, we drew 1-1. But even then, you had a fan say, that's a good result, isn't it? But it's one of them things that, You don't have to go through it, but you go through it and you actually come out better for it because, and I know it sounds really stupid, but because when we had Liverpool in the semi-final later on in the year, that was what went through our mind. It might have given Liverpool a little bit of complacency as well. It might have done, it might not have, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I did see Liverpool go 1-0 up with Rush and they all just sort of, lads walked back to the centre circle just to say, this could be another 4 or 5. And in our head, there's doubts until we scored the equaliser and we thought, well, okay,
You won 4-3 in... Yeah. Oh, sorry.
Well, just before we talk about the semi-final, you mentioned the team bath there, and we were talking about this yesterday. The team bath is really something that's been phased out.
when you think about it,
it's pretty disgusting, right?
Like, absolutely disgusting. Just, how do you get in that? I actually look back now and I think, see some of the things that... I mean, the way, like I said, now it's all individual baths. You have a nice bath now, you have the saunas, you have... I mean, the top teams will have all of that, but I don't... It's just bizarre, isn't it? Just in the bath, which is, you're probably the 15th one to get in that bath.
And what's it like in there? Are you chatting or are you...
Yeah, you're just talking about the game as if, like...
as if you're not in a bath together.
Yeah.
But it's like a hot... Now it's all ice baths, but back in then, it was like a hot...
Was it hot?
Hot? Bubble bath. Like, I've seen pictures of bubble baths. Yeah. So like bubbles in there.
Yeah.
But that can't be good for your body recovery or anything, can it?
But do you know what, though? We still played 2 games in 2 days and played a Christmas period and never just got on with it. It was just a done thing. And this is when sports science people come to me when I'm working and that and give me these graphs and everything like that. Yeah, and like I said, I've never sort of said, no, it's not, because it is, because like I said, the game has moved on. But I remember, my answer to them was Alan Hansen played 60 games in 81, won the European Cup, the League Cup and the Championship. On pitches that were what they were, by the way, their recovery was a pint in the players' lounge afterwards. That was their recovery. And they still got on with it. So yeah. I think we've gone too far the other way.
Did you go and did the two teams have a drink together after the game?
Yeah.
What was that like after the 9-0?
That was, well, I remember you going in there because you want to go in the lounge because there's all celebrities in the lounge. As a young lad, you think...
Especially at Anfield there.
Especially at Anfield.
Jimmy Tarbuck.
Jimmy Tarbuck. Stan Baldwin. They're all there. Whale of a time. You know, you look back now and that great Liverpool side, all the great sides back then and the recovery, and you just couldn't... You tell the young players' stories. And this is my thing with young players now, is I remember saying to young players at Palace, what's going to be your stories in say, 20 years' time coming onto a show, yeah. Josh, when you guys are still be doing it and talk about football in the 2000s or something like that? What would be... Because they don't talk. They just text each other. They don't talk. Yeah. They don't go out, you know?
We'll be all asking them about the WhatsApp groups. That'll be what it is.
Yeah, that's what you will be. Yeah, you will be. Yeah, absolutely.
Actually, WhatsApp groups are great, because we had Dave Besson, and he's in the crazy gang WhatsApp chat. Are you in a WhatsApp, a Crystal Palace WhatsApp from your playing days? Any teams, commentary or anything?
Yeah, we all keep in touch. Yeah. We all keep in touch. Especially the sort of commentary era, I think, you get onto it, 97, 99, wonderful players and wonderful, wonderful team led by a great manager, Strax, team spirit. So we all stay in touch, Noel, Telf, Paul Williams and that. And with Palace, probably Chris Coleman, I'll stay in touch with Chris. But it's one of them things with football that I remember leaving Coventry and staying to, well, Steve Staunton there, I remember saying to Stan, I said, I think Stan was leaving. I said, we'll stay in touch. He went, no, we won't. I went, yes, we will. He went, no, you won't. Yeah. And I kind of get what he says, because that is what you do. And I tend to, when I'm on a long journey, I'll go from my phone and I think, well, I've not spoken to you for. So I'm actually quite good at doing it. But and then you meet up maybe two and a half years late on a coaching course. So I'm like, hello, mate, how you doing? Oh, I've tried to get hold of you. No, you didn't. But once you get in a room, like I said, the room like this, say all together, and you're having a few drinks or whatever like that, then it all just comes flooding back. And
so let's go to the FA Cup final, which must have been amazing, because you're a young player at that point. Yeah. So you've beaten Liverpool 4-3 in the semi-final, which must have been astonishing experience. Then you record Glad All Over, your FA Cup final song. Yeah. Was that a fun experience?
It was an amazing experience.
Did you sing live?
I think it was live.
Really?
Yeah, it was live. I was sort of in the back row. I mean, John Slarko thought it was Luther Vandross. He was just hogging the whole thing, I'm going to be honest. But it was brilliant experience. You know, it's something you sort of think you'll do it again.
Yeah.
But you don't realise how lucky you are to play in one cup final. You've no idea.
And back in the day, when cup final day is such a big event.
Huge event.
It must have felt so exciting to, get the suits and all that kind all that.
Josh, it was brilliant, you know. And I grew up watching the teams on the coach with the cameras and everything like that. Yeah. I remember we had an agent. Remember Eric Hall?
Eric Monster.
So Eric was looking after our players' pool, shall we say.
Yeah.
And I think he had a deal with... It might have been Ray-Bans or something, I can't remember. So... He used to be getting a coach on the way to cup final. We said, don't forget, you've got to put your glasses on. So we get on the coach with these big glasses on. And it was like the Today newspaper. Do you remember that? I think they did that. So we get in the coach and we start opening the Today newspaper and start reading it. But basically, if everyone can see the Today, so to make sure everything was seen. And then we had a deal with High Tech. We had to wear High Tech boots. But I think loads of lads were wearing Puma, blacked them out and just tip-exed. just so we could get paid. We forgot there was a game. All we kept hearing was Eric getting on our ear. Don't forget this. Don't forget that. You got to expose that. But it was. The day you can't put a price on the day. I mean, for me, has FA Cup been devalued? Possibly.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Should it be? No. It's just a wonderful, wonderful team. I think you must look back in your career. I'd like to see the guys now. What would you rather win, the FA Cup or come fourth in the league? I'd rather win the FA Cup.
Yeah.
And that's something you got. I don't get it now. I just don't get it.
You so nearly won.
Yeah.
3-3 after extra time.
Mm.
That did it feel gutting by the end?
Yes.
And that's because it goes to a replay on the Thursday.
Yeah.
That must have been a weird experience, because you think this is the big day and then suddenly you've got to kind of rouse yourself.
Yeah. If Thursday, Josh, to be fair, was we had a worst kit ever as well. We had this new kit, what Palace had never worn. I think it was yellow and black stripes, which was a one-off.
What you had to wear for the...
We wore for the replay because Manchester United wore red.
Right.
So we changed colours. And first to go, we had to offer the claret and blue, or red and blue, sorry. And we were 3-2 up with about 7 minutes left and Mark Hughes scored. And you always know, even back in them days with Manchester United, you sort of know you only get one chance.
Yeah.
Because they were just a good side, and not as good as when they got to the 90s, mid-90s, late-90s, shall we say, but... They had wonderful, wonderful players.
Yeah.
Brian Robson and Paul Lynch, Steve Bruce, Pallister.
You played left back, didn't you? Were you up against Neil Webb?
Right? I actually played in midfield.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I actually played in midfield. And I was up against Neil Webb. We had 3-3 in midfield, and I was given the task of marking Neil Webb, which was a brilliant task, because Webby didn't really go too far, so I could just, like, stand next to him. Whereas if you had the task of marking Brian Robson, he was up and back, up and back, and that was a tough one. So me and Neil Webb swapped shirts afterwards, and that was great, because there wasn't a drop of sweat on us. We were just standing in centre circle. So he was good as gold, but... But yeah, you only get one chance,
because I guess like you weren't favourites, so no. you don't go in there expecting to win necessarily.
No. But when you're there, you've got a little bit of a worry that you want it to go well because the whole world's watching.
Yeah.
And you're playing Manchester United, and you think, well, Liverpool 9, Palace 0. You don't want another scenario of anything like that. But
and what was it like coming back on the Thursday then? Had you got plans? Like, were people like, oh, God, I was going on a holiday? Or...
Do you know what? I bet some of the lads probably did, to be fair. But I think back in the day, you'd book it a travel agent, wouldn't you? So you'd probably have to go to the travel agents and cancel
it. Go down to Lumpolly and play the FA Cup final.
It's not like online now. You just cancel, is it? You've probably gone in there. But, yeah, it was. I don't remember too much of the game. The game wasn't great. I don't think we had too many chances. And, you know, they scored, obviously, Lee Martin scored the winner. And like I said, it was... sort of anti-climax from the first half.
One thing that did happen, because Jim Leighton was at fault for the goals in the first game, is Manu changed goalies to Les Seeley.
Yeah, they did. Yeah.
What was that like when you found out about that in the dressing room?
You kind of, for us, it didn't mean too much because we just get on with it. But this is why I think Alex Ferguson is one of the best managers that we've ever seen, because he makes the big decisions. That would have been easy to have just stuck with Jim, thinking they're going to beat Palace anyway. That might have been their mindset. But then you to stick with Jim would have been the easiest thing to do. But to do what he did just proves what a wonderful manager that man was to make the big calls. I think Les gave Jim his Cup Winners' medal, I think.
Did he?
Yeah, after the game, I believe.
Really?
Yes. Oh, wow.
Yeah. I might be wrong in that.
Yeah.
That's what I heard.
So that you finished third in Division One, but then the team kind of starts breaking up. Ian Wright leaves, Mark Bright goes, and Steve Coppell. Was there a sense that the team was being broken up?
Yeah, definitely. And I sort of sense that in my later days with Coventry, we have a big success, shall we say. It's a shame because 91, we came third. I don't know if it meant a lot to everyone. We won the Zenith Data Systems Trophy.
Have you still got your medal?
Oh, I've still got a medal, yeah, somewhere. We won. A bit Everton 4-1 after extra time, I think it was. So that was
at Wembley game. Again.
At Wembley again, yeah, at Wembley. So good enough for us. It was good enough for us. we was okay with that one. It was okay. Yeah. And then the team was we came third, you know, and that in the Premier League days, pre the Premier League, obviously, was just an unbelievable achievement.
Coming third when you've just come up two years before.
Yeah, and the fact that we were banned from Europe at the time. I mean, Palace would have been in Europe as well, which who knows.
And then maybe the team would have stayed. Yeah,
the team might have stayed. I wonder whether Ian would have stayed, because I think Ian, you could see Ian, he was just head and shoulders above everyone there. And you could see he's getting superstar status, shall we say.
Yeah.
He was all going to be destined to move on.
Were you aware of that then?
Yeah, we was. And the lovely thing about Ian was when he went to Arsenal, he got all of our phone numbers and he phoned every single person individually.
Oh, man.
And said, like, thank you for everything. You sort of helped him along the way. You know, not that I set up too many goals of it. I don't really know why he called me. But it was a lovely thing to do.
Yeah.
You know, and just give you a bit of advice or say, look, good luck going forward and this and that. And I thought that was the mark of the man, you know. I really do. It was a fantastic thing to do.
Yeah. And then around this time, coming through the youth ranks, Gareth Southgate.
Yes.
Did he wear a waistcoat back then? Or was it...
No, his fashion wasn't quite as good as it is now. But again, we had a wonderful period of youth players coming through there at Palace, and it was rightly or wrongly, it was a school of hard knocks, and you learnt quickly. You know,
was Gareth Southgate a hard kind of, because you don't get the feeling? I know he makes tough decisions as the England manager. He seems like such a nice bloke.
He's a lovely guy. He's an absolutely lovely guy. But don't get fooled. He's very, very strong minded. He knows what he wants. Even as a young player, you know, he got in the team. He was captain of that team from quite a young age. Alan Smith, because. Alan loved him because Gareth was like really clean cut, proper, you know, school, everything's right, shirt and tie, done up to... He really was. But he was just a wonderful, wonderful guy. Even now, I look at Gareth now, proud to have known him, proud to have played with him and proud of what he's achieved, you know, because he was a great young lad. He really was. And you know, and he's done brilliant in his career, because Gav's come into an environment of Palace, South London, and, you know, the characters that were at the time, and it would have been quite easy to have gone under with some of the stick you would have got.
I would go under. Yeah. In a heartbeat, yeah. I would be gone.
Well, I've seen so many good players, and I always take some development, Josh. I always say, the youth team's easy. When you're in the youth, and one bit of advice Steve Coppell gave me, and he gave for probably all the youngsters, is the first contractor you get will be the easiest one.
Yeah.
Because you're in the youth team, you're beating 15 players that we talked to, and you're scoring in the South East Counties, this FA Youth Cup thing, which now is a phenomenon, which I never really get, I have to say, because it's just another game for me. But where you build your character, contracts 2 and 3, where you're in a first team environment or reserved environment, and you're in that environment training with the first team, that's where you build your character.
You became a bit of a yo-yo club at that point.
Mm.
Like, you're going up and down.
Yeah.
What's more fun, struggling in the Premier League against top players or being in the Championship, as it's now known, yeah, and Joe, thinking, really, we're bad
really,
at this?
Really good question. Really, really good question. Obviously, being in the Premier League, obviously, is or what it was Division 1 back then, is obviously the highlight. No one wants to get relegated. I think the year we got relegated in 93... we finished in the top four of everything. I think we finished fourth from bottom because the four teams went down. We got to the last four of the FA Cup semi-final, Manchester United again, lost to them. And we got to the last four of the League Cup and we lost to Liverpool. So we always was in the four of everything. And we was the only, I think it was the only time four went down from the Premier League. We lost to Newcastle away and we got relegated. And then in 94, we came back up.
Was that like a fun season where you're like, oh,
do you know what? It was a great season.
Really?
It was a great season.
When you come, but then when you do come back up, you're not like, oh, next year's going to be hard.
Well, we had so much fun coming up in 94 that we didn't even think about 95. It was really good 94. Fantastic environment. Chris Coleman was established. Gareth, you know, we was quite a young side. Smithy was manager. And, you know, we played the games and then we'd go out on a Saturday night and then we come in Monday and then we go out again and we go down a pub or something like that. And we won the league. I think we won the league. And it was just the atmosphere and team spirit. I mean, there's different ways to be team spirit, but it's so important. If there's a togetherness, I will say it's worth 10 points. Easy. Yeah. You know, there's a real togetherness.
And back then it was really organised around nights out and alcohol, essentially. Was that the crucial component in your kind of team spirit? It sounds
like we just looked at the fixtures and thought, where are we Saturday? We're at Manchester. Oh, where can we go Saturday night? We didn't think we had Manchester United or anything like that. Where can we go Saturday?
Oh, man, that'd be good. But how would that work? Would they let you know, say, like, you don't have to come back on the team bus, like, you can make...
We always did, because we had a good camaraderie of the lads. It was really good. And then, you know, we had Paul Stewart on loan as well from Liverpool, which added to it. You know, it was good fun as well. And it was just, I don't know, it just seemed to be that you come back and then on the coach, there'd be a crazy log on the coach. On the way home, you just like, oh, Alan Smith coming down a coach at one stage saying, you know, lads, just take it easy. We got Nottingham Forest or something on Tuesday. But yeah, no problem. And then as you're saying it, we just... Paul Stewart got these lagers just in black paint. I don't know, someone blacked them out and just said something like 12% in gold writing on it. No one even knew what we were drinking. No one had a clue what we were drinking. Yeah, just take it easy, lads. Yeah, just pass another one.
We come now to one of the most iconic moments in the history of English football. We mentioned it at the start. So is it right that you were told you were marking Cantona before the game? No, is that okay?
No.
But you're known to be a man-marking expert.
What, why were you so good at man-marking?
It's because of the way I was so good at cleaning, to be fair. I've just given a task and I just got on with it. So
is it easy man-marking? Do you stick to someone?
Actually, mentally, it's quite... you have to be really switched on, because I've been given a task of maybe just get close to him. Like Zola, for instance, I remember... Money man, Highfield Road, marking Zola, and you know, I think he was a bit peed off. Last time we saw it was in Italy with Gentile, and there's me, Richard Shaw, thinking, who's this little funny man with me? I've been marked by Gentile, I've been marked by Costa Crow. That mentally it's quite, because.
Do you chat to them? I've heard like jockeys when they're going around, they'll chat. Like, if you're stood with a guy for 90 minutes, are you acknowledging, like.
I have to say, Zola was brilliant.
Yeah.
When I was marking Zola, he was brilliant. He was talking, and after the game, he was great as well. You know, you sit down and have a chat.
But quite friendly.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah, he was just an absolute gentleman, I have to say. at St Gentleman.
But do you want that? Don't you want to be a bit of aggro and like you want to hate the person you're marking almost? Like,
yes and no. Yes and no. I mean, there's like with Eric, I was never told to mark Eric. I mean, it's just a myth. I mean, there's so much has gone on. Like how Alan Smith said, you've got to get into it. No.
So all that thing that you were kind of, it's been reported that you were kind of winding him up because you thought you might get a rise out.
Yeah, I've seen it, yeah. Not a chance.
No?
Not a chance. Manchester United come to town, Andy Cole's had been bought for $7 million or something like that, wherever it was, and he made his debut against us, I believe. This is the thing, you can mark Eric, but there's another 10 players. Yeah. You've got Kanchelskis and Giggs, you're like, how the hell do you stop them? Then you've got Cole, and then you've got Robson, you've got Keane, you've got Ince. You're like, what's the point of marking one person? So that's a myth for a start.
Yeah. But you just fall, supposedly, the way the team's set up, you just...
The way it was set up, myself and Chris were centre-backs, and I've watched the game back many times because I had to be clear in my mind because I remember there was one stage where, so I won't name him, someone had bought a book out and someone had said about I was smashing him and things like that, whatever it was. And I sat around the pool in Menorca and I was thinking, this ain't right. So I phoned a guy who's represented as a lawyer and I said, right, this enough's enough. And he looked at it, he said, right, it's defamation of character. And so I was actually going to go ahead and just sue him for that because I'd seen the game back. So I knew it wasn't the case. Then I found out how much it would cost to do that. I just thought, I think I'll give that one a wide.
Let's come on quickly, clever, and clear it out.
I just thought, well, okay, I'll just put up the stick that comes my way now. But it did get to that because everyone just jumped on the bandwagon and writing books about it and things like that.
I guess they wanted to justify why he acted like that, and so we're trying to find someone.
But if you look at Eric during that year, if you look at Eric's career...
It wasn't a one-off incident.
It wasn't, no.
But he stamped on John Moncur the season before. We were playing Swindon. There'd been another incident, I think, earlier that season where he'd kind of bit...
John Polston at Norwich. And do you know what, though, Chris? I've got no issue with that because I always think... I like a bit of devilment in players. I like seeing it. And I think it's because he cared.
Yeah.
And I think what he achieved at Manchester United is nothing short of sensational. And I'll always say that because people want me to sort of say, oh, yeah, Eric's it. No chance. He was a wonderful, wonderful player. He really was, you know, and he changed that team in the mid-90s, what he achieved. And if he had that little bit of devilment, so be it.
So what was it like when he kicked you?
It was just, I think he just got frustrated, to be honest. I remember there being a throw-in and I had this habit of just wrapping my legs around on throw-ins and just pinching the ball away and things. And I think the whole game, I think, at the time was 0-0, I think.
Yeah.
So, and they were going for the league title, obviously, and it was a game that they really wanted to win or get something from, surely, you know. And it was just literally that, long ball, and maybe just Eric just got frustrated, but it was nothing more than just a chip.
And when that happens, do you think he's gone here? There's a red card coming.
Do you know what? I didn't even know if he'd been booked.
Yeah.
I wasn't too sure, Josh, to be honest. And I've just been on the floor. And like I said, I was just literally sat there. I think Cookie had come over to me, blah, 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 something. And then all of a sudden we heard this noise and like I said to you before, I saw Chris Armstrong sprinting towards the incident. I'm thinking, well, where's he going? What's he doing? And then I didn't see the footage until probably that evening time. And obviously...
Are people in the dressing room when you go back in, are they going, did you see what happened?
Yeah, yeah.
And you must be going, come on, that didn't...
I actually was, I was thinking, no chance. Until you see it back, you know... And back then, I guess it is a big thing, full stop.
Yeah.
But I thought it was great. Someone said in Manchester United dressing room was even funnier because... I think Gary Pallister tells a story about when Fergie's gone in there because they drew 1-1. I think he'd hammered Pallister and Bruce. I think, and said, you won that game. He's hammering him, right? And I think he's just telling Eric, because Eric, you can't do that, son. And he just carried on hammering everyone else, and he caused the biggest scene of it. Eric, you can't do that, son.
Have you ever crossed paths with Eric since? You ever seen him anywhere?
I haven't. No. We played. I think every time we played United, we went to Old Trafford, it was always get the ball from throw, and it was a boo, like I said, you know.
Oh, really?
You know, I was totally blamed for the incident, which was quite funny. But honestly, I can't speak highly enough of how good he was. You know, him and Mark Hughes, it was just a fantastic partnership. That United team in 94 is one of the best teams I've ever played against, alongside the Arsenal team in 97.
Yeah. Now, that year, Palace were relegated. You're named Player of the Year for Palace, and then you get called up by Terry Venables as cover for the Umbro Cup.
Yes.
What was the Umbro Cup?
The Umbro Cup was a pre-96 tournament.
Like a warm-up for
them? Yeah, with Sweden, Brazil and Japan.
And what was it like turning up at England?
It was nervous. Yeah. I was really, really nervous because I was in Tenerife the week before with Chris Coleman, Gareth, John Humphrey. Six of us went, Ricky Newman, David Matthew. And sat around the pool, I think one night, because Chris was always winding me up. Back then, they never had no phones. You had to walk to a phone box to ring home, didn't you?
Yeah.
We never had a mobile phone. Chris said, you've got a phone home because you've been caught up by England. I was like, yeah. Sitting around the pool, I'll have another beer. He said, no, I'm being serious. You've got a phone home. I went, and I just thought, because I was so stubborn, I thought, no, there's no way you'll get me to phone home. So I left it for a day or two. And then I phoned up Paula, my wife now. And I said, how you doing, blah, blah. She went, where you been? Because you've been called up by Terry Venables on the phone. Or back then it was Ted Buxton. I went, are you serious? And then I had to literally fly back the next...
What, so you hour. Just carried on with your holiday for 2 days without realising?
Carried on without realising. But we wasn't meeting up till maybe the week later. But yeah. When I got back, I sort of done a sort of mini pre-season for 2 days by myself. Yeah. And then I Burnham Beaches it was. Sent a car down, went to Burnham Beaches. First time being involved with international side. And it was really, really nervous, but it was the most wonderful, wonderful experience to train and play with the players. And I know some of the guys couldn't be bothered to turn up or didn't want to turn up because they wanted a break. I get that, but you make your own luck in life.
Yeah.
But I just enjoyed the whole 2 weeks, just being in that company and the sessions and training and meeting, because it was Gary Neville's first meet-up as well, or David Unsworth, so we sort of...
Yeah,
sort of hung around together as such, but the lads were just brilliant. The characters, I mean, Gazza was just as a player. Oh my God, he's just no one could get near him.
Yeah,
incredible.
Was he like fun to be around as well?
He was. Yeah, he was. You know, he was always the sort of joker. I think we had apple crumble one day with a load of crumble on top, and he just literally scooped all the crumble off. And sort of put on his plate, and there was plain apples left, and no one was too happy. He was always
doing, say all the crumb.
Yeah, he was always doing something. The stupid as it was.
Just to wind everyone up.
Just to wind everyone up.
Just to play a crumble.
Yeah, play a crumble. I think his hair dyed blonde. I think it was off the Rangers that year.
Oh yeah,
the Rangers. So he sort of back and forth from sorting that out. But again, he made me feel so welcome because I was a new boy.
Yeah.
And for that, I'll always be thankful. Himself and the more senior ones in. Steve McManaman and Jamie Redknapp were very good with me as well.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah, that was a really, really good experience. A shame because, obviously, I didn't get the move from Palace. I was obviously leaving Palace, but I didn't move till September, I think. By then, really, sort of had to stay in that sort of league to be part of that squad.
So,
really.
Was there... Because then you moved to Coventry that autumn for $1 million. When you got relegated, were you thinking, I need to move back to the Premier League here?
Yeah, I think... Rightly or wrongly, I mean, I think a lot of players think that. And I look back now and I kind of think, could I have handled it better? Probably yes. You know, because I look back now and think, right, teams have been relegated and we're all in it together. We've all been blamed for that, you know. I find it sometimes I think maybe I did the wrong thing.
Really?
You know, at times. So I do sort of regret that a little bit. And maybe I could have done it a better way, shall we say, rather than being a paper to go, I want to leave, blah, blah.
So were you handing a transfer request, was it like?
Yeah, I did. And I kind of like look back now and think, it's just immaturity, really. You know, young man, and you see that.
You've just been in the England squad.
Yeah,
I mean, it's going to turn your head, isn't it? You've
played
with Gazza and...
And then you're getting this advice from, obviously, people outside of football, you know. It's that as you get older, you get more wiser, and you kind of think, right, OK, what would I do now? I would handle that better. Yes, I would. And I think there was overtures from like West Ham and Tottenham and bits and bobs, and you hear the sort of things. And then I think I got to a stage where I just thought, right, the next team that come in, I'm going to go because, you know, I think I've done my time really, and I think it was a bit toxic, the wrong word, but I just needed to do challenges.
Big Ron must have been an exciting person to.
Do you know what, Josh? He was so funny. When Coventry came in, I was like, Coventry. But John Slarker had just gone there in the summer, and I could see what they were trying to do between the team. So I went up to speak to Ron, and we sat down in his office. And the first thing he said was, all right, son, good little guys, how would you mark Les Ferdinand? it wasn't even a how are you or how's your family. How are you going to mark Les Ferdinand? I was like, right, he's just thrown it straight at me. And do you know what? It was just brilliant. And he was telling me if I signed, these are the areas to sort of live and buy a house. Or and Gordon Strachan came in and said hello. And I just thought, Joe, it made you feel
Was he amazing to play for, Ron?
Yeah. Do you know what, Josh? I can see why he was so successful at West Brom and Manchester United, because you sort of look at that and you think, right, West Brom was such a good side at the time, and Manchester United were just a good side. They should have won the league in 94. But the common denominator, they didn't really need coaching because they were just wonderful players.
Yeah.
But us at Coventry, we needed guidance.
Yeah.
We needed that. Whereas when one would come out and it would be like Strax would set something out. Strax was way before his time. People talk about Wenger and that. But I remember Gordon Strachan, and he'd come out and every session you'd be on a pitch, he set something up and it sort of linked into each other. Really good coach, thought out well, this is what we're going to work on today, this is that.
Yeah.
One would come out and just go, take one look at it, he goes, what's all this in? You get the apprentice and goes, right, clear it off, five aside, that's what we're going to do. And then Ron would come out in his Predator boots, yeah. Ron on the tongue. And
Ron on the tongue!
And then we'd do crossing and finishing sessions and Ron would be out on the right-hand side, pretending to be Manny Couts, and he would, like, you have to ping the ball out to Ron. And if it went literally a yard either side of it, you wouldn't move for it. And then he'd chip this thing into the centre for Dion. The keeper would catch it, and he would just hammer Dion for not getting on the end of it. He was a brilliant, brilliant character.
He was like a leader of men rather than a tactician.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. He had his thoughts, and obviously, he's a good manager. You know, he's not stupid. Don't be successful as that without being not knowing the game. So he knew the game, but it was just the way his flamboyant character. I loved him. I genuinely did, and you know. We were struggling at the time, and then Ron left, obviously, and Gordon took over. And that's when I think I went up another level with Gordon because of how he was. And he was a good tactician. His sessions were really good. And not that Ron wasn't. Ron was very good. And it's a shame the way Ron sort of left football in a way with what happened, because for me, I can only speak for myself. He'd done so much for me.
Mm. Yeah.
So I'll always speak well of him.
And did... what was Gordon Strachan like when...
Brilliant. I think he's probably the best manager I've played under. Steve Coppell gave me the opportunity, that is for sure. And I regard them two as you know, real pivotal figures for me at different stages of my career. And Gordon just, you know, he just taught me then how to sort of play out from the back and overall football thing, rather than just being known as a man mark or something like that. There's more to your game.
Yeah.
And he was brilliant like that. And of course, it's well documented with the diet and the way you look after yourself. And he would do the training, and he'd do pre-season at 45, and he'd just win everything. It was just ridiculous. We'd do a fartlek, 45-minute fartlek, and he'd lead it. And we were, like, out hanging, and he's like... I had so much respect for him.
Because there was a point when he brought himself out of retirement. Yeah, did the players take a bit of offence at that?
Which is so good. We actually begged him to play. Gaffer, you've got to play. And you know, the two games we had were Arsenal and Chelsea, and it was that Zola game. It was Arsenal and Chelsea at home, and we won both games, I think. And basically, that made us stay up. And I don't think the gaffer could walk for about a month. he had to play because he was so influential.
Yeah.
Wonderful, wonderful manager, wonderful, wonderful coach. And it was just a wonderful period of my playing career and life. The two or three years when we was 97, 99 with the players we had. I know you've got Carlton coming later, Carlton, Gary Mack, David Burrows, Huckabee, Whelan, Telfer, Steve Fogger. It was just a fantastic period, great period.
And is it the end of your first season? You play Leeds the last game of the season to stay up. The tension in those, I mean, are they the most tense games you've ever played?
That was 96, Chris. It
may have been, yeah.
Yeah, because the following year it was Tottenham, wasn't it? The following
you did
year.
2 years in a row, you two stayed up in the last game of the season.
Yeah.
What are those days like?
They were tense. I mean, I think the Leeds game, I think we drew. I think we just needed a point.
It was the one where Man City didn't realise that... it was UV Man City. That's not it. UV. That Man City...
Man City didn't realise. They thought a draw was enough for them.
Yeah, so
that's the famous clip of Niall Quinn telling him, I've just seen it on teletext, we need to win.
That's it. And they're keeping the ball at their back, strolling around. Everyone's going, man, what are you doing?
Are you hearing the scores when you're...
You get a vibe. You get a vibe from the fans.
Yeah,
you get a real vibe. Obviously, if they're effing and blinding at you, you sort of know you've got to pick up a wee bit. Yeah. If there's people crying in the stadium, you think we're in trouble. But when they're you get a vibe. In a perverse way, it's a great atmosphere to play in because if you come through that, and I always think adversity makes you better. If you come through that, Well, I say we come through that. We did it again next year. You can't come through it that well. If you do come through that, it does. There's something good about it.
Binds you.
You haven't. All you've achieved is staying up. Like the following year against Tottenham, where we had to resign, three results, kicked off 15 minutes late, and we still stayed up at White Hart Lane. There's people in the changing room crying. I remember Gary Mack crying, and you sit there thinking, we're just deliriously happy. But we've stayed up.
Yeah.
And to some, that's not an achievement, but to some, it is an achievement because it's just, it's one of the best leagues in the world.
Yeah.
To stay in. It's so easy just to go down and start again.
And what are those nights like? Do you go out on them?
We was off to Iron Napa, I think.
Late 90s.
After 97. I think we was off to Meetel for Whelan and Hux. We used to go away for just a few days just to chill out, really.
What was Noel Whelan like?
Ah, he's fruitcake. Noel Whelan is just incredible talent. That's one thing I will say. He signed for me at the same time, more or less, a couple of days, and he was 19. And he's one of the best young players I've ever seen.
Yeah.
He had energy, talent. I think the only one that would compare probably slightly better, the best young player I played with, probably Robbie Keane, when Robbie came at 19 for Wolves. But Noel... It's just 2 million come from Leeds, unsort of known in a way. Strikes off, you had him at Leeds.
Yeah.
What a player. What a player. He just, with Noel, he just liked a night out at times. And he was just, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, he'd get involved in a few scrapes at times. And that you think, come on, you could be anything, you know.
Yeah.
And to be fair...
Is that frustrating to kind of...
What frustrates me about talented players... And I wouldn't put Noel in it because Noel did work hard.
Yeah.
Noel did. What annoys me about talented players is they've got so much talent, but they don't have the application and the attitude to go with it. And then it becomes a waste.
Yeah.
And I think because myself, and I heard Stuart Pearce talking about it the other day, actually, and he said the same thing, you know, and I would never regard myself to Stuart Pearce. Stuart Pearce was a wonderful, wonderful left back, absolutely unbelievable player. But his attitude got him a lot of the way in his mindset. Yeah. You know, and I see so many talented players now, I just think that's enough.
Yeah.
And it's far from it. And I see young lads now being guided by clueless agents. And I will say that, you know, and telling them the wrong things and, oh, your talent's fine. No, it's not.
Yeah.
It's not. You've got to have the whole package to go with it.
What category would you put yourself in? Natural ability or application?
Application.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I make no bones about that. I played till I was just short of 40. I'm very proud of that. And what got me there was my sheer bloody-mindedness and my upbringing with Maurice Struer at Palace, with what I went through, you know, at home. We never had that many money at home. So you find a way. And my attitude was that, and it still is. And there are more talented players than me. We're going to be honest. Players than me. But my attitude and my commitment to my profession and my sacrifices that I've made... Gets you a long way.
Yeah.
It really does.
When you're at Coventry, have I checked the dates for this? Were you there for the Dave Boost?
I was. Yeah. I didn't play in that game, actually.
Didn't play in that game.
I didn't play in the game.
Were you in the ground for it?
I was injured, so I wasn't in the ground until I saw the footage come through.
How did that affect the club?
Yeah, it really did. It really did. Because he was a wonderful teammate as well, Josh. He really was. He was, you know, you talk about attitude, you talk about, you know, over talent at times. Boosty, I mean, be the first to admit that. He worked and worked and worked, and he deserved everything he got playing in the Premier League at Coventry. Great, great lad. Worked hard at his game. And for something like that, it was so sad to see. Because I don't think I've ever seen anything like that.
No.
The players must have been really affected.
Yeah, right? Really affected. Really, really, really affected, to be honest. It took a while to get over that, you know, because every day you obviously see Dave walking in and, you know, what he's had to go through and a rehab and everything like that. But he's surrounded by a lovely family and he still works at Coventry now. So the club have looked after him, is the wrong word, but he has an affiliation with the club where, you know, he's doing well.
Yeah.
In a brighter note, 1997, you play Chelsea and they bring the wrong kit.
Yeah.
What I was reading about this. So Chelsea, did they bring a clashing kit?
They obviously come in blue. And Chelsea being Chelsea, and I always think with Chelsea, I always think Chelsea's got a touch of arrogance. And I get that.
Yeah.
I get that because the King's Road, and you go back to the 70s with Osgood and Hudson, and they are party animal, shall we say. Yeah. So I do understand that. And then I remember a couple of years before that, when I was at Coventry, I think they beat us 6-1 with the keeper sent off. And I think they beat us 6-1. And Ken Bates came in a change with a crate of champagne and said, unlucky, lads, you kept it down to 6, but well done. And he put his crate... I remember, I think Carlton picked up the champagne and started throwing it and told him where to go. I was cold about it later, wasn't it?
Note it down.
So Chelsea have always got that.
Yeah,
arrogance.
Sort of, arrogance, yeah. And I get it. So when they walked in, it's funny because at Highfield Road, because Highfield Road, the tunnel's there, and he used to walk in. We used to leave our door open, and we used to see the teams walk through. So we always had an idea of their sort of mindset. So Manchester United were coming back in the day, Fergie, they would always be shirt and tie. Shirt, tie, trousers, and you think, they mean business. They actually mean business. Sometimes Chelsea would come in. When Chelsea came in, it was like with Casiraghi and all them people, big sunglasses and everything like that. You think, well, OK, you know, we're going to get into you now.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, one leg up, one leg down, and everything bowling in and collars up and whatnot. And it was always that way. With Manchester United, that's why I love them in the mirror. Proper club like Juventus and Bayern Munich, do things right.
Yeah.
And so I played the wrong kit, and I think Rude's come in and just basically come through the door and sort of said, well, we're not changing. But we're at home. We're the home team. You have to change. And it's because it was Rude was thinking, well, my name's enough, so you lot change, basically. And it was like a bit of a standoff, and they had probably one of our worst away kits with the red and black check squares, and they were running around the blue shorts. It just didn't go, you know. You're talking about Chelsea from the King's Road turning up in that. I think we won the game 3-1, and I think some of the Chelsea lads just took, after the game final, just took a shot, just threw it on the floor and just walked in. But look, it is what it is.
That's hilarious.
They get the wrong kit, and we get blamed for it.
It's mad that happens in 97. You think there's something that would happen in the 80s?
Just win a yellow kit. I mean, every time we play Chelsea, they always wore the yellow kit.
As a kit man, you've got very few things to get right.
Yeah.
It's bad.
One job, as they say. You've got one job.
Then Coventry, you do well. And then eventually in 2001, I think it is, you go down. And did you have offers to move back to the Premier League?
No, not I can remember, Josh, to be honest. I think it was probably a period in my life where I was quite...
Happy.
Happy. Yeah, I had a couple of children. My wife was living down south. I was going back and forth, and it's one of the ones we had a few things up north, but I wasn't too fussed, you know. I was enjoying where I was living at the time.
When you're a football fan, you don't realise at all that players have a personal life, really. No. And that's like that, such a big thing in decisions that are made, your family, wherever they move. When you're watching your team, you don't ever think, God, this person's had to move 250 miles away.
I know. Well, with
I know usually with Plymouth, they have had to move.
Plymouth free Carlisle, you must have done that journey.
Yeah, it's a long old journey.
But I just think that there's a lot of this. Oh yeah, but they've earned that. They should be doing it. No, because you still have a life.
Yeah,
you still have a family, and you still. I was quite happy. I've always been. If I'm quite happy, I that'll do me.
Yeah.
I've never been one that's got to chase this. I've always been quite happy. And at a period of time, you know, I was okay. The club was. I know we got relegated. It wasn't great. Of course, it wasn't. But you could see it coming as per Palace. With, you know, you start selling Dion goes, Darren Huckabee, George Boateng, Chipo Stave, Hadji goes. You're talking about an unbelievable side just constantly
eroded,
getting broken up. Yeah. Bobby Keane. Also goes to Inter Milan. You're just like,
so you want to stay here?
Here you go. I remember I came in late one day, and Bobby was getting changed from his kit into his jeans, and I think I was injured, so I come a bit late, and I'm like, where are you going? And just as nonchalant as that, he just goes, just off to Milan, talk to Inter. And I was just like that. Oh, right, okay. I'd be doing cartwheels, but you could see then he was an old head on young shoulders.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Wonderful, wonderful player. Yeah, oh, yeah. My God. We was injured. We used to go out. I used to put my injuries. If he's injured, we say to the physio, look, can we come back at 4 and get treated until 8 o'clock tonight? Because we want to go and watch Robbie train. Because training, he just...
Oh, really?
He was just brilliant. And senior players would just go out and watch him train. You couldn't get nowhere near him. You couldn't get nowhere near me. He turned up in this jeans hanging down his backside. He was like... bright white, it's like a young Irish lad, and you know, and I just think 6 million. We're like, poor, well, okay, but then you see him train. Oh, my God.
Was he the best player you played with at Coventry, would you say?
Certainly one of them.
Yeah.
Best, I will say best young player I've ever seen. I played.
Wow.
Best young player I've ever played with. You know, he's just unbelievable. But Ronan Nielsen, in terms of professionalism, Ronan Nielsen was just unbelievable.
Wow. Really?
He was just unbelievable. Wonderful. Great player. Great right back. He really helped me because he sort of played next to me and I played centre back.
Yeah.
Gary McAllister again, you know, he just a legend. Just, I don't see anyone pass the ball like it. He had the fade, the draw, dropped it. He had every
pass. Well, he ended up going to Liverpool and like his kind of period of his career after that as well.
We all thought he was like, I remember at Sheffield Wednesday, I was going, so Macca, where are you going now then? Where are you going to go after the season? This and that. We just thought he was going to like maybe drop down a level. Or go somewhere. Next thing you know, he turns up at Liverpool. You're like, wow. And then he wins five trophies or something like that. He's like, good player. I mean, he probably helped Stevie Gerrard as well develop as well, playing alongside Gary, because Gary was, you know, it made my job easy. I just get the ball, just give it to him. Even if he had three or four players around him, there you go, Gary. You know, he just made my life so easy.
Yeah.
Brilliant player.
Yeah, you stayed at Coventry. I mean, you became a kind of Coventry legend in 2006. You get your testimonial.
Yes.
Which, 25,000 fans.
25,000
fans. That is a sign of popularity, isn't it?
Oh, I think it's probably a sign that Celtic came down as well. Which obviously helps. I think they just won the league. And I was saying to you earlier, Josh, it was quite funny because I had a great night.
Yeah.
I had a great night. But it was just one of them things where myself and a guy called Tony Finch, who looked after my testimonial committee, he was doing that, and we went in to see the chief exec, and we said, look, about testimony this year, I think the chief exec thought I was going to get someone like Solihull Moors or something like that, right? So he said, like, we'll pay for the police, we'll pay for the ground, we'll pay for everything, we'll make sure it's all sold out. So we got that right, yeah, get it right in there. As it goes on, I sort of know in the background with Strachan at Celtic, I sort of know that I know it's going to happen. And then they won the league. I never forget where I was. I was in my house in Banbury. They won the league. Phone goes, Strachan, she goes, we can come down the 11th of April. And then she won the league about a week before, and it with timing couldn't have been any perfect, right?
Yeah.
So I've gone in next day to the chief exec. The testimony with Celtic, my mate kind of goes, yeah, you're still going to want to win it? Yeah. Oh, we got Celtic. And you can just see his whole thing drop thinking, oh my God, what is this going to cost? Because it's... And he said, oh no, you have to do that. And we just said, no, look, there you go. That's what you signed. That's what you're committed to. And so maybe there might be a few thousand that got paid, but who cares?
Yeah.
Who cares? It was a one. It looked great. It was
so
a great.
You get to keep the money in those days from a testimony.
Yeah,
that's amazing. Were you walking out there trying to add up the car?
No, do you know what? Do you know what, not at all, because it was probably one of the first times my wife had been to a game, and I had two daughters. I got three now. I had two daughters at the time, and my family had never really been up because my wife hates football. She hates it. It doesn't make any sense to her. And, you know, my brother-in-law and his family came up, my in-laws came up and everything like that. And, you know, friends, it's the first time sort of seeing everyone together. And to me, that meant a lot, walking on the pitch with my two daughters. Well, my middle one, Verity, was crying. My eldest one, Rowena, was just milking the backside of her. You'd have thought it was her testimonial. She was walking around, she was waving at everyone. I've got all the pictures, and the pictures just give me so much good memories, you know. And Celtic were brilliant as well. I mean, they were, I mean, them fans, I mean, I know.
Do you have an away end in the testimonial, or is it kind of...
I mean, Celtic scored, and I think it must have, after that, everyone just stood up. It was just, it wasn't a way in. The Celtic was just atmosphere. But the Coventry fans as well, you know, it was nice for them as well because, you know, I had a good affiliation with the Coventry fans as well. And, you know, I like to think if you've given that service and you've given all, you know, I've sacrificed my family life because I came home for 10 years. I was home twice a week. For 10 years.
Wow.
You know, I missed my children growing up and things like that because Gordon Strachan phoned up on the first day. If I went in that house on the first day, he'd phone me up. I know what he was doing. He was making sure I was there.
Yeah.
So for 10 years, it was. And I know people say, oh, yeah, but it's still you still miss out on your children growing up. So that was kind of hard, but the game made up for it in terms of having everyone there. And just seeing everyone and just what a good event it was.
And how does it work on a testimonial? Do you go in the Celtic dressing room and go, look, we want this to be 2-2. I want to score. Is there any of that conversation happening?
No, there was none of that. I think,
get a penalty?
I think we won. No, do you know what? I actually didn't want that.
The pressure?
Because I would have missed it. I actually did. Because you know what? I remember playing against Russian Diamonds. Remember Russian Diamonds?
Yeah.
I think the League Cup, we were 9-0 up and with a penalty. And everyone kept shouting, my crowd, Haifa Road, chanting my name to take it. And I didn't want to take it. I thought, if I miss this, and I gave it to a, I never forget a young kid called Robert Betts, who was a young youth department. He said, you take it. You're starting out. And he took it. I probably got booed for it. The crowd were going. But do you know what? It never bothered me. But no, I actually wanted testimonial to be a game.
Oh, really?
I didn't want it to be like five-a-side or anything like that. Yeah. I wanted it to be a proper game. And it actually ended up being a proper, proper game. So it was a lovely, lovely evening. It really was.
What was the score?
We won 3-1.
Oh, decent.
We won 3-1.
Good result. Yeah,
so because they're normally like 9-7.
Yeah.
Games, aren't
yeah.
They? Yeah.
Oh, I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. Really good day. Really good evening.
Nice end. Then you go to Millwall. Lovely club.
Do you know what, Josh? Do you know what? It's so funny because I was sat around the pool in Mallorca with my wife.
Yeah.
I was out of contract. Months ago, I ain't got another club. I wasn't too fussed.
Things always happen to you when you're sat around a pool. You always get big news.
It tells a bit about my lifestyle, doesn't it? But I always seem to be, also about time. And this guy phoned me up and said, look, do you want to come to Millwall? And I just went, ooh.
Well, you just told me you're a secret West Ham fan.
Yeah, because I'd followed West Ham as a youngster. Yeah. And I was just like, the Millwall thing as well, because obviously with the reputation that Millwall has with the crowd, etc. And obviously I'd felt that when I've been there at Coventry and things like that. I had felt that. I wasn't too sure. And then my first thing was, do you know what? I'll come along, because I was going to be the under-21 manager, but also play with the first team, bits and bobs. I'll come along and see how it goes. And if I don't feel this and I don't like it or any abuse, I'm going to go. You know, I wasn't too fast. But do you know what? What a great 6 years. I had two as a player, four as a coach, and I bought into everything, the club, the fans. It's just brilliant, you know.
Chris not enjoying this as a
I know. I get that. Millwall has the reputation it does because of the supporters. But even the supporters, if you get everything, it's like any club really should be, just run around. if you run around and you show commitment and you show you really care, and if you lose and you show you want to win and everything like that, they will back you. And you see, when we got to the player final, it was about, I don't know how many it was, we played Scunthorpe, it was about 70,000 Millwall fans and 5,000 Scunthorpe fans. You know, but I ran around, but I can't speak highly enough of it, the football club. I really can't. I know it has the reputation. I know what it does in the community in terms of everything it does with the youngsters and racism and that. It does so much. It does so much. But I just think it's always got that stigma. But for me, I really, really enjoyed it. I've really enjoyed my time there. And the people there treated you really, in terms of directors, chairman, treated really well. Really well.
Skull hating. Yeah.
I know, Chris. As much as you don't...
come on. Well, you know. Subjective. So we heard that you may have listened to a couple of episodes of this podcast. So we wanted to, you may know there's a few myths we have here. We want to
end by asking if you could answer.
See if you could bust that. Did Chris Bart Williams have small feet? Do you ever get up close?
I've never heard that one.
There's rumours he's got really tiny feet. Was it like size 4 or 5?
I don't know. It might have been size 6.
Jeff Thomas had size 4 feet.
Really?
Jeff Thomas was
size 4. He didn't have to pay VAT.
Size 4 or 5 is like his boots like that. Chris Bart Williams, never heard that. No.
Well, we'll change it to that. Jeff Thomas. Yeah. You played with Nigel Martin at Crystal Palace.
Yes.
What were his favourite drinks?
Because
we found a thing in Match
magazine
where he listed his favourite drinks, and they were bizarre. Was he a drinker, Nigel Martin?
Not really.
No.
Not really. I'd guess coming from where he came from, was cider, Formal. I guess. Yeah. Something along them lines.
He was Cornish, wasn't he?
Cornish, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice bloke?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he came here, had his tash and everything like that. Back in the 80s, you did, didn't you, I guess? A great goalkeeper.
Yeah, brilliant.
Unfortunately, I mean... For Perry, it was obviously not a great time. But when you let 9 in at Anfield, I think the club wanted to make a change, and that was the catalyst of it.
Yeah.
But Nigel was great. He really was. In terms of favourite drinks, I don't know, Nigel.
Two final questions. 4 goals in 587 appearances. Were you going up for corners? How does this ratio explain itself?
No, do you know what? I never went up corners because for me, it's too much. You run up there and you never get the ball, you run back. So I just think, if I can just stay back there and just organise, which is what I was quite good at, that's what I did. And by admission, when I look at the goal scorers now, people who naturally score goals, it is an art. It's a talent. And it is, everyone keeps looking for number nines and goal scorers, and somebody who scores 20 goals a season will win the league or kick you up. They will, but they cost money and they are good at what they do.
Do you wish you'd scored more than four goals?
Nah.
Well, that's a
huge
job.
Nah, not really. Nah, not really.
Because you can remember all of yours.
I can, well, that's the beauty of it. I still have the Goal of the Season trophy at Coventry. What's that? One every 150 games or something like that?
We asked this final question of all of our guests, but I think this question has a special pertinence to you. Would you go back to the 1st of January 1990, just a few months before that first FA Cup final, and do it all again if you could?
In terms of the career?
Yeah, go back and live it again.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you know what? I loved it. I just loved it. It was just a great time to play football. It was a great time to play football. And no regrets at all. Regrets at all. I loved it. Even my month loan period to Hull City back in 89, it was the best thing I've ever done. Drove up to Hull in an XR2. 8 hours. No phones, no sat-nav. Big Atlas, not knowing. Just makes you grow up. So, no, I wouldn't change a thing, actually.
Not even tell Eric Cantona, just maybe calm down.
Possibly, yeah. But no, I loved every minute of it. I loved every minute of who I played with and who I met.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Richard Shaw, thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
That was Richard Shaw, and finally, Shaw, the series after Huckabee. If we get any more, we don't talk about Coventry emails, really. We do. We don't talk about anything else.
We've had a few creep in from Sheffield Wednesday, so I wonder whether they're going to be the next big one.
I do feel bad, but, you know, don't worry. What happens is we get these emails. I'd like to say we don't rise to them, but absolutely, we just follow what you guys say. So, David Hurst, if you could just give us a call. On the Coventry thing, we are in... Not negotiations. Dion Dublin is going to do the podcast at some point. We're very confident of that. He's been very nice in text. However, a little quirk has appeared because of that. Chris, you love this, don't you?
So, this is the mad thing about this podcast and the weird things that happen because of it. And this is
I've been texting Dion Dublin back and forth. Lovely bloke, right? Never met him. But the highlight is he refers to Holmes Under the Hammer as Hammer. But you know, at the start of lockdown, where everyone thought house party rather than Zoom was going to be the way that people spoke. So I've got that on my phone, and I've still got the push alerts set up. And, you know, some people have just added random people randomly, and there's no reason. For some reason, one of the 10 people on my house party app is Dion Dublin. And I reckon... I don't think there's anyone in the UK using House Party more than Dion Dublin. I reckon I get 15 push alerts a day saying that Dion Dublin is in the house.
I can't believe that if I had that kind of proximity to Dion Dublin, wouldn't you accidentally hit that and just see what he's up to?
Wouldn't it be awful, having never met him or spoken to him, but only texted him, to suddenly be house partying Dion Dublin, face to face?
And then you click on it and he's in there with Gordon Strachan, Noel Whelan's there, Darren Huckabee, and you have your time of your life.
Would you enjoy that evening if you got mistakenly pushed into the house party of Dion Dublin and his old Coventry pals?
I'm thinking about moving home. Maybe I could ask Dion for some advice. Has anyone been on Dion Dublin's Wikipedia recently? Because the first thing it says on there is he's a TV presenter and former footballer. Surely he's a former footballer and TV presenter. Like, it's such a whitewashing, Stalin-esque approach to history.
He is primarily a footballer and he always will be. But thank you to Richard Shaw.
Okay, that's it for this week. We'll be back next week as Ben Partridge joins us to finish off those famous Gillingham documentaries. Let's find out how Adi Akinbaye and Tony Pulis got on there. Until then, Robbie Slater.
See you later. Every time you're skipping down the street, think about the shoes upon your feet. Today is a magic world when your toes. Shoo, 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 shoo.